This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We taxpayers will be paying the bill for the savings and loan scandal for years to come. And that's a pretty good incentive for us to try to understand what happened and who's responsible for it. The new book, Silverado, uses the rise and fall of this Denver SNL as a case study in the kind of go-go banking and deregulation that led to the collapse of the industry. The book also focuses on Neil Bush, who joined Silverado's board of directors in 1985 while his father was vice president, and resigned in 1988, shortly before the bank was closed down by regulators. Neil Bush and the other directors of the bank were sued for gross negligence by the FDIC. Bush was also charged with and found guilty of conflict of interest because of business dealings with two of the bank's biggest clients. My guest, Stephen Wilmson, is the author of Silverado. He also covered the story for the Denver Post and the Denver Business Journal, and he broke the Bush conflict of interest story. Silverado's go-go banking style took advantage of deregulation. Silverado got rid of small depositors and boosted interest rates to attract large depositors. Then the SNL went mad lending money. I asked Wilmson to explain how and why they operated this way.
The why is almost as though there was this testosterone-driven need to get bigger and better faster and as fast as possible. The how was that they simply took as any loans that they could take. In the beginning, particularly, we're talking before 1985, they would ask other savings and loans for their rejected customers. They would send them over to Silverado. They would do the paperwork, and voila, they'd have a loan. And they did this. They did a number of things, but this was, you know, they would take anyone that came into their shop and gave them big loans. After 1985, they had a stable of real estate developers who were very steady customers. People like Bill Walters and Ken Good, who became sort of nefarious figures nationally in the savings and loan crisis. They developed this wonderful symbiosis in which the real estate developers would get these huge loans, I mean, massive loans, far and above what they actually needed for their projects. They would take some of the money and pocket it. Some of the money would go back into Silverado in the form of stock. In other words, Bill Walters comes to Silverado and says, I have a $10 million project. And Silverado would say, okay, we'll lend you $20 million. And they would take $5 million, put it in their pocket, another $5 million, they would buy Silverado stock, thereby making Silverado look healthier than it actually was, recapitalizing it in effect.
So this was part of the kind of scratch my back, I'll scratch yours deal. We'll give
right.
you a lot of money if you take some of that money and buy our stock, so we'll look real healthy.
Exactly.
In your book, you make a lot of connections between deregulation and the behavior of the SNLs. And mm-hmm. here's an example. You say that part of the reason why SNLs like Silverado ended up loaning so much money to big real estate developers was that as part of the Economic Recovery Tax Act, real estate developers were given this huge tax break.
Mm-hmm.
What's the connection there?
Real estate developers... this was part of the Reagan administration's effort to get the economic engine of the country going. And essentially what it did was it allowed real estate developers to form partnerships that could get investors from all over the country. They could essentially sell shares in these partnerships to build a building or to develop a shopping mall or whatever. And an investor could buy a share of this, and it was essentially a tax-free. It was a tax break. And so the incentive became to invest in these things, not because, or if not because it was economically sound, not because a town like Denver or anywhere else needed a new shopping mall or needed a new office building, but because there was a tax break there that was so lucrative that they could pour money into it and come out clean whether or not it was a failure. And so these real estate developers had all kinds of money to throw around. And part of the connection is simply that that money poured into real estate, and real estate became the game to be in, and it overinflated that market.
Well, the government rescinded the real estate tax break in 1986. How did that affect the operation of Silverado?
Well, it affected it like it affected a lot of other businesses in this town and across the country, but even more so because they had built their empire on overvalued real estate. And when the real estate values crashed, suddenly they have all these loans on their books that no one can pay. And furthermore, they can't even begin to sell them because they were overvalued to begin with. They can sell them for a tiny fraction of what they had made the loan for. And so they're stuck with a lot of real estate that they have to foreclose on and nowhere to put it, nowhere to sell it. And therefore, they had huge losses and ended up with liabilities that far exceeded their assets.
Now, Ken Good and Bill Walters, two of the biggest real estate developers in Denver, who had already been getting loans from Silverado, what happened to them and to their need for more money mm-hmm. when that real estate tax break was rescinded?
Well, this is where, in my mind anyway, the really nefarious stuff begins, because oil prices really crashed in 1985 and 1986 in a number of different jolts. And the same thing with that tax act. All of these things came together at once and really devastated the economy here. It did the same thing in other places, but we very much rely on oil, or did at the time. And when oil and real estate both crashed, this town was in big trouble economically. But Bill Walters and Ken Good and Neil Bush managed to develop, and Silverado, develop a wonderful symbiosis in which they could... it was like a sort of a perpetual motion machine in which they could all hand around money in this big shell game, and they all prospered while other people were beginning to fall off the table.
Well, you, I believe, are the one who broke the story that mm-hmm. Neil Bush, who was on the board of directors at Silverado, was actually business partners with these two real estate developers, Ken Good and Bill Walters. Mm-hmm. They had each loaned a lot of money to Neil Bush's oil company. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
And Neil Bush didn't exempt himself when the board voted on whether to give loans to Good and Walters, mm-hmm. presenting a conflict of interest.
Yes. There were other sort of more nefarious things in there, but the gist of it is that he had, essentially, his oil company was never successful at all, and that he was, Ken Good and Bill Walters, through loans and gifts and other types of investments, were paying his salary, a six-figure salary, and keeping the lights on at J&B, which was Neil's oil company. And at the same time, they were turning to Silverado, where he was on the board, and asking for huge amounts of money in loans. Neil never interjected that they were paying his salary, even at times when it was clear that, to him anyway, and not to the rest of the board, that neither Walters nor Good could pay back those loans. And so, in effect, what it was Neil was getting money from them when they were getting money from Silverado, when he knew that they probably could not pay it back to Silverado.
You broke the story about the Neil Bush conflict of interest. How did you find out about it?
It was, I wish I could say that it was through journalistic cunning and vast resources, but really it was mostly happenstance. I had decided more or less that the Silverado story was sort of dead in the water, and that people were generally tired of hearing about the savings and loan crisis, and certainly my editors were at the time. But in any case, I went down to the Colorado Secretary of State's office, which is a repository of various documents and so forth. And really what I was looking for was the possibility that people at Silverado had lent themselves money, and I was looking for favorable terms or just anything else that I could find along that line. And I took with me a checklist of all the officers and directors and began going through them. And when I got to Neil, I started finding some interesting things, namely that Bill Walters and Ken Good, these two very wealthy real estate developers and two of Silverado's biggest borrowers, had actually helped Neil fund his oil business when he first came to town. and that furthermore, that money had continued to pour into Neil's oil business. I took all these documents and I went back to my office, and not knowing quite what to do with them, I began to call around to regulators and some other sources that I had. And finally, I connected with one who I just put the question to and said, is Neil under investigation? And there was this long silence as he pondered what to do, and I could hear the telephone wires swinging across the country, you know, one of those uncomfortable silences. And finally, he said, yes, he is. And it unfolded from there. We ran with the story the next day.
What did you say in the story?
That Neil was, that his oil business had been funded by Ken Good and Bill Walters, two of Silverado's biggest borrowers, that they had defaulted, that Neil was under investigation for conflicts of interest involving those borrowers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Wilmson, author of the new book Silverado, Neil Bush, and the Savings and Loan Scandal. And Wilmson covered the story for the Denver Business Journal and the Denver Post. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Stephen Wilmson, author of the new book Silverado, Neil Bush, and the Savings and Loan Scandal. Now, the Silverado savings and loan ended up under investigation, and Neil Bush resigned before that investigation went public.
Mm-hmm.
There is some question here about whether he was tipped off in advance so that he knew to resign beforehand. What information do you have on that?
Well, it really is more a set of circumstances and coincidences that that no one may know for sure. But Neil resigned from the board. And remember, the backdrop to all of this is the 1988 presidential campaign. Neil had sort of stalwartly remained on the board, and then suddenly in August, a week after the first correspondence between regulators took place to saying that they were going to close down the savings and loan, Neil suddenly resigned and said that he didn't want there to be a conflict of interest. And I suppose it's ironic that he suddenly became sensitive to the conflict. But he suddenly resigned, saying that it was a conflict with his father's presidential campaign. He didn't want it to get in the way. It could have been perfectly innocent, but it is a coincidence that it came just a week after those the first correspondence took place.
Under investigation now, I believe, is the possibility that the federal investigation into Silverado was postponed until after the presidential election, the election in which George Bush was elected president. Where does that investigation stand now?
The investigation stands deep, deep inside Washington bureaucracy, and I think that it's probably unlikely that it will come out. Actually, the circumstances of that were that the investigation, or the examination, rather, that the federal regulators did had all been completed. And a team of federal regulators had been in Silverado for more than a year, wading through the muck and trying to untangle these very complicated deals, and finally unraveled Silverado's true condition and found that it was insolvent and deeply, deeply insolvent. And they moved to close the institution very quickly. And there's a vast bureaucratic machinery that has to get going in order, particularly at that time, in order to close a thrift down. And that machinery was moving when suddenly a call came from Washington that said, please delay closing Silverado for 45 days. And the machinery stopped. And then it didn't start again until the day after George Bush was elected president on November 9th.
Is that call a rumor or a certainty?
No, that's a certainty. There are documents that show that. The final keystone of this of the process in closing down a thrift is something called a recommendation memorandum. And the memorandum was prepared in October and then not signed until November 9th.
Let's try to get into the details of how the conflict of interest actually worked. Mm-hmm. Neil Bush is on the board of directors, two big real estate developers who are investors in Neil Bush's oil company. Apply for loans from Silverado. Bush is one of the people who votes to give them the loans. So then what happens? They get the loan from Silverado. And how does that benefit Neil Bush?
Well, I should say, first of all, that they were in some ways more than investors. Particularly Ken Good took Neil under his wing and brought him out to his mansion in south of Denver, which was this big sprawling estate, 33,000 square foot house, and he would have him work out at his health club that he had built into the place, and they had their meetings out there at the house, and he gave Neil a $100,000 gift to invest in commodities and so forth. And these people, by the way, were gamblers. I mean, they were out on weekends. They'd jet out to Las Vegas and play blackjack for $50,000 a hand. But when they would go to Silverado and ask for a loan, then Neil would approve the loan, which is, by very specific internal policies as well as federal regulations, is a breach of not only your duty to the institution, but also of very specific policies. That they would ask for the loan, he would approve it, and then the loan, some of that money would end up coming back to his oil business, which was not making any money on its own, and yet they were paying his money. So in effect, they were supporting his lifestyle. And almost by turn, Silverado was really supporting his lifestyle.
And what does the rule say about conflict of interest in such cases?
That if you have any relationship that either constitutes an actual conflict or even the appearance of a conflict, that you are to A, inform the board, and B, abstain from voting.
So what was the outcome? Refresh our memories. What was the outcome of the federal investigation into Silverado and the suit that followed?
Well, you're talking about the investigation after Silverado was closed down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shortly after Silverado was sealed shut in December of 1988, a group of lawyers that were hired by at first the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, later the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, began sifting through this huge warehouse of $15 million pages of documents. And for almost 2 years, they spent going through these, building a civil case, and finally brought it to, it didn't actually go to trial, but actually it was settled out of court. But they had sued for $200 million and finally recovered almost $50 million. The other investigation that had happened concurrently was one on Neil specifically, and he was found guilty eventually of the conflicts of interest, and the penalty that ensued was little more, well, even less than a slap on the wrist. He was told essentially not to ever have conflicts at a savings and loan again. The other thing that is ongoing now is a criminal investigation, and that has been underway for at least 2 years and may go on for a couple of more years before we even know whether there will be indictments handed up.
What's Neil Bush doing now?
Neil has been hired by a cable TV company and has moved to Houston. Is mostly traveling abroad, largely in Japan, where he's glad-handing and pressing the flesh and selling cable TV systems. Which is a very shrewd move, by the way, because in Japan and in other countries, the savings and loan crisis doesn't mean nearly as much as it does here, and the Bush name carries a hell of a lot of weight, and he is, as I understand it, being quite successful.
You interviewed Neil Bush several times before he stopped speaking to the press. What were some of the most revealing things that you think were said during those interviews?
Well, he's a bit like I imagine Dan Quayle to be. He's very scripted, first of all, that when you interview him, his eyes kind of glaze over and you can hear the machinery moving as it decides whether this is a suitable question to answer, and if it is, then how he should answer it according to his rehearsed line. So he was never very spontaneous, but I think that probably what was most revealing about him was his sense that he hadn't done anything wrong. It was never anything that he said particularly, but it just shed off of him this arrogance that and this belief that he had not done anything wrong. There was not in his mind any kind of conflict. And even when the press and the court and everyone else had so adamantly proven that there was something wrong, it was very simple logic, that he couldn't seem to perceive it himself. And I think that in that lies not only Neil's downfall, because he was so adamant about that he became a scapegoat and became sort of the focal point of anger about the savings and loan scandal, but also that this was the attitude of all of the savings and loan people that I ran into, both in covering it for the paper and in doing research for the book.
So what story are you on to now?
Well, I think that probably the aftermath of the savings and loan crisis, particularly with the Resolution Trust Corporation, is turning out to be, at least in some corners, a dismal failure that I haven't lost hope for yet, but that contains pockets of, in some cases, actual fraud, I think, and greed and motivations that in some ways are on par with the savings and loan crisis itself. We now have a massive, massive bureaucracy that is trying to solve the savings and loan crisis, and it is tripping over itself. We're having inside the bureaucracy people with their own personal ambitions and with politics guiding the way more than the notion of getting the job done and getting the job done right. That, I say, would be the next story for me and something that I'm concentrating on.
Stephen Wilmson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen Wilmson is the author of Silverado, Neil Bush, and the Savings and Loan Scandal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.